We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions. Hello and welcome to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 28 with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and myself, Chris Webster. Today we talk about astronomy and we continue our definitions of types of rock art. And at the very end, we get into dating methods. All right. Welcome to the show, everybody. It's Chris Webster coming at you again, which can only mean one thing on the Rock Art Podcast, and that means I'm interviewing Alan. Every time you guys hear my voice, it means I'm interviewing Alan.
So, hey, Chris. Hey, Chris. It's Alan right here, right next to you. Where are you right now? Where is Chris Webster in the world?
We're literally on opposite coasts. I'm in North Carolina. Oh, wow. And you're in California.
Yeah. I'm at home here in Bakersfield. So I'm on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And you're on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And it sounds like we're right next to one another. The clarity and resolution on this podcast is impressive.
It's technology. There you go. So on this show, we are going to continue talking about, as I mentioned in the introduction, we're going to continue talking about different types of rock art and things like that. We had a whole list of things. If you go back to episode 25, which was just a few episodes ago, you can see we started kind of defining rock art again, talked about some of the basics, some techniques for creating, things like that, even pictographs and how we get some of the paints and pigments and applying them to the pictographs. We talked a little bit about pit and groove style and cupules. So we're going to continue on with some more definitions and kind of telling you all about what really encompasses the world of rock art. But Alan, something topical right now that I just thought about that I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
Is one of the things I'm really fascinated by is archaeoastronomy. And right. Rock art has a huge interplay with archaeoastronomy. And we've had people on the show talking about archaeoastronomy. And one of the first things that I can remember seeing that I know was definitely interpreted this way, and this is what it was, because you may have seen rock alignments before, listeners, and not known you were looking at something that was aligned to some sort of astronomical event or, you know, solstice or something like that. But one of the things I saw that was super cool was the supernova pictograph and Chaco Canyon. And that is it's a pictograph drawn on basically a ceiling, for lack of a better way to say that, but under a ledge. And it's meant to symbolize the supernova that took place in, what was that, 1050 or
1154 AD?
Like that. Yeah, 1054. And the Chinese talked about it. Everybody talked about it, right? Everybody who was writing at the time talked about it. And even the Native Americans in Chaco Canyon, and that was right during the, you know, some of the height of Chaco Canyon, drew this pictograph right on this ledge representing that. So I'm bringing that up because we just had this great conjunction of Jupiter Saturn hit its peak last night.
That's right.
Have you heard of something like that being represented that we can definitely say this is what that represents? Or, I mean, I'm not sure if we could even say that because it doesn't happen that often.
No.
And I'm not sure how they would do it.
Well, you know, in the broad sense, this discipline of archaeoastronomy, we had Ed Krupp, who was the director of the Griffith Park Observatory, on one of our podcasts, and he kind of waxed poetic and talked about how he got involved in all of this. But this archaeoastronomy discipline or sub-discipline amongst the study of rock art is fascinating in a myriad of ways. One of the ways to think about it is to get a sense of what indigenous Native American people see in the heavens and how they choose to capture it, either in a painting or a rock drawing, and also perhaps even in a rock alignment per se, or in viewing the horizon and relating to a particular intersection of the sun or the stars in a certain way to then understand something from a cosmological standpoint. So what I'm talking about, you know, sort of to wax poetic here, besides this major conjunction that only happens once in every millennia, basically, is just yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, was the winter solstice.
Right.
December 21st. Well, that winter solstice, I never understood this until relatively recently. I go, what the heck is a winter solstice? And they tell me now when you, if you begin to understand this, is when you study at the movements of the sun throughout the year, it moves across the heavens and it systematically moves further and further in one direction and then stops in its travel and sits relatively stationary for 3 days,
Yeah.
And then turns around and moves back. So one of the sites that I had heard about throughout my life and seen photographs, slides of, was done by one of the pioneers in archaeoastronomy, Robert Schiffman, who was a professor at a community college, Bakersfield Community College. And he was the first one to recognize that the Indians in the South Fork of the Kern River here in California, Southern California, were astronomers. They were recording in painting and in the placement of their rock art some of the most important elements of their cosmology. Well, when the winter solstice sunrise occurs, it's perceived as an end of a cycle. And at the end of that cycle, the world stops and it renews itself. And cross-culturally, the winter solstice is that time in really the end of winter where the waning of the cold and the moving to the, you know, the further time span of the regeneration of life, because after the winter comes the spring. So in other words, what they've done in many instances is either depict a phenomenon on a painting site or align an alignment or rock alignment on the ground to identify exactly where that intersection occurs. So for instance, at Mary's Cave in the Eastern Mojave Desert, they have a rock shelter that if you stand there at that rock shelter, you will see the intersection of the sunrise on the horizon at a particular point during that cycle. Same thing with the large, there's an immense boulder, It's hanging off the side of an arroyo and it's split in two. You can see it from the highway. That's how large it is when you're just driving by on what they call Highway 178 that goes from Bakersfield up over the Sierras and down into the Western Mojave Desert. If you glance over, you can see that boulder. If you stand in front of that boulder, if you look at the painting shows that they were counting and they had a big line that went up the top of the boulder and there are tally marks. But besides that, there is a depiction of a mountain, a V upside down with the rays of the sun coming up behind it. Well, that's interesting. Well, it was Bob Schiffman that said, you know, I think this might have something to do with the movement of the sun. And when you study the California Indians and Native Americans in general, the number one association or astronomical association calendar element is the winter solstice sunrise. That is the most important event. So if you stand in front of that boulder and you look towards the horizon, which I'd never done before, and when someone in my office coached me and said, you know, Alan, you should go out there and get those Indians to reinaugurate their sun ceremony. So I did that. So on a very cold and freezing morning on December 21st, we made our way over to the boulder on the side of the mountain. And we didn't know precisely when the sun was going to crack the horizon. So we're there early, like 6:30 in the morning, even more freezing. Mm-hmm. Well, we waited to 7, still didn't come up. Waited till 7:15, still didn't come up. And then the light started across the back of ours. And as it moved towards 7:30, we began to see the light shining over the top, the peak of the highest peak in the far Southern Sierra, Owens Peak. And as it drip, drip, drip up, this glowing orb, this incredible orb, the sun, sits there on the top of that peak at that point for quite a while. I don't know if it's 20 seconds or whatever it is, but it's a while. Wow. And you're sitting there looking at this and going, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, okay. So speaking from a modern perspective, it floors me to think that anyone in, you know, pre-modern times could have that awareness of their surroundings to know, to even note when the solstice is. You know what I mean? Like, we have people whose job it is to track those sorts of things. We have powerful satellites and telescopes and all these measuring devices. Like, we know exactly when stuff like that is going to take place, but we forget how, I think what that says to me is we forget how connected to the landscape and the universe and the heavens that people were back then, because they were in it. They weren't distracted by video games and TV and jobs and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, of course, they had to, their job was to survive and provide for their family and live and do stuff. But they were so connected to everything else around them. And we just kind of forget that. And I think this is one thing that really teaches us, is when you see these astronomical alignments, you know, mirrored in rock alignments and things like that. It's just amazing to me that they got it right, you know.
Now, in certain foragers, in certain hunter-gatherer cultures, complex hunter-gatherer cultures, for instance, with the Chumash, mm-hmm. who are on the coast, they worship the sun. Mm-hmm. And they had a series of specialists who were sun watchers. That was their job. And so as it moved across the heavens, they had to predict its location, and they in turn had certain ceremonies or certain rituals and cosmological mm-hmm. elements triggered with that kind of phenomenon. You have to remember that the reason we have Christmas is because we tried to take a pagan holiday, winter solstice, and mm-hmm. turn it into the precise birth date for Jesus Christ, because it was December 21st, December 25th. They, in essence, tried to then overtake that particular holiday to produce another holiday. Mm-hmm. And in the indigenous cosmology, that winter solstice is, again, a time of renewal, reinvigoration, world renewal, etc. Mm. And if you look cosmologically on other elements, for instance, in the Catholic Church, it was when Juan Diego saw the apparition of the Virgin of Guadalupe. It was on the winter solstice sunrise. Mm.
Well, there you go.
We can talk about this till the cows come home. I mean, there's such a deep and abiding connection for the indigenous mind, the indigenous understanding.
Yeah.
All things have agency. In other words, the sun was a living, sentient being. It wasn't mm-hmm. just a body in the heavens. It wasn't something that was foreign. It was part mm-hmm. and parcel of one's understanding of life.
It's interesting, too, because I wonder, you know, because many cultures around the world have thought that about the sun, right? I mean, probably one of the most famous ones that almost anyone can mention, if they really had to think about it, is the Egyptians, right? They had the sun god Ra, mm-hmm. Ra, and they were big sun worshipers for a long time. Mm-hmm. And It makes you wonder what they thought about, like, Egypt. You know, Egypt is in Africa. It's never cold in Egypt, right? It's always hot there. And it's even close to the equator, which you know, makes it even hotter, right? It's just right. Like you got pretty much the same temperature all year round. I was in Tanzania one time, and that's right on the equator in October. And it was basically 12 hours of dark and 12 hours of daylight pretty much all year long. And it was just, you know, they didn't have any of that shifting because that's what life on the equator is like, right? The further you get from the equator, the more extremes you're going to have with that stuff. But anyway, it makes me wonder when they look at the sun as like a godlike figure or a god in a being, what do cultures think about the sun in the wintertime when the sun is no longer seemingly providing warmth? You know what I mean? Like, it just provides light, but not warmth.
Let's think about this, you know, from a broader cosmological nexus. And as it turns out, I've done the deep dive into that for a variety of reasons. There's an entity, a linguistic entity known as Uto Aztecan. It's a linguistic stock. What does that mean? It means it's a bunch of languages that are genetically related to one another.
Right.
It means the Great Basin languages. It means Hopi. It means a lot of different languages in Mesoamerica and Mexico, including Huichol and Aztec and Maya, what have you. So what do they think about the sun? What do all these Uto-Aztecans think about the sun? Well, for one thing, the sun is hot, right? And the sun shines in the day. And the sun is a powerful, powerful force, right? But you need the sun to create life. It helps things grow. And that was pretty logical. So what they felt was, what was the sun? It was a man. It was male. Because it was hard and strong and daylight and intense. It had all that male energy associated with it. Where'd the sun live? Well, if you look at the horizon, right, where does the sun come from? It comes from the underworld. You see it on the horizon, and it births up from the underworld, from the horizon. So then we know that that's where the home of the sun must have been, in the underworld. So what's the opposite of the sun? Well, obviously, it's the moon. Why? Well, the moon is dark. It's at night. What also happens? The sun is always the sun, right? What does the moon do? Well, the moon is unusual because it grows, is created, destroyed, and then reborn every 30 days, right?
Right.
So what is the moon? Well, it's a woman. Of course it's a woman because it's birth and creation, right? She gets pregnant, she has a baby, and then da-da-da. So you've got the woman and the man and the alternate forces. Well, what did the Aztec and the Maya believe? Well, they were alternate forces against one another. They were fighting for domination of the celestial sphere constantly, right?
Right.
What do you see when the sun sets? You see that sunset where it's all red or orange? That's the blood of the fight that was happening during that interface between the moon and the sun. So the sun rode on the back of an eagle, and the moon rode on the back of a jaguar. And the jaguar has spots, so those were the stars in the sky. And this, and you have this ferocious fight back and forth for domination. And if one wins, we're in trouble because we'll either have all day or all night.
Right.
So that began to dominate their cosmology, and it's depicted in all of the architecture and all of the codices and all of the religious rites. And at some level, you see that in the paintings, in the rock drawings, and in the material culture of these people that are all inter-ethnically related and linguistically tied from, you know, 10,000 years ago on up. So the reason I paint that sort of word picture is when you see an animal or a picture of a sphere, a moon or a sun or a snake or a mountain lion in a painting or a drawing, it has cosmological import. It's not just a picture. It has a tremendous story behind it.
Okay. Well, that is a great place to take a break. So we're going to do that and come back and keep talking about these things. I didn't know by asking that question that, man, we would take a whole segment on that. But I shouldn't be surprised, right? There's so much to unpack here and so much to talk about. So,
well, thank you for asking.
That's right. Let's take a break and we'll be back on the other side and continue talking about rock art. Back in a second. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code ROCKART. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast. This is episode 28, and we are talking about, well, we started talking about astronomy, but now we're going to get right back into some of our definitions and different types of rock arts. And I've got two bullet points here, Alan, and I'll remind you of these as we go through, but
thank you.
I want to talk about the differences between rock alignments, geoglyphs, intaglios, which is a real interesting word that a lot of people probably haven't heard, and ground figures, and maybe discuss some examples of each.
Yeah, so rock alignments are, what they sound like. They're lines of rocks, and rocks are just, set on the ground, realigned in some sort of a shape sometimes as figures, or more commonly, just as a line. And you're going, why in the heck do we have this line of rocks that goes on and on and on? Out in Eastern California, they're all over the desert. Rock alignments here, Panamint Valley, just north of Ridgecrest in Eastern California, is one of the places I know that has tremendous amounts of these rock alignments. Well, it turns out that those rock alignments sometimes they're dancing circles where they have certain ceremonies. Sometimes they align themselves with certain celestial bodies. It can be the winter solstice sunrise. It can be the summer solstice sunrise. It can be a certain star. And the most common stars that would be demarcated would, of course, be Venus, which is known as the morning star, or the evening star. And right. The native people did not know that Venus was a planet and that the morning star and the evening star were actually the same star. They saw them as two distinct stars. It's one of the brightest things in the heavens, and it's always associated with rebirth. But rock alignments in general will have that. Now, rock alignments are different from geoglyphs or intaglios because geoglyphs or intaglios typically are on desert pavement. Desert pavement is a place in the desert where the natural environment, the natural climatic elements, have wind blown and water blown all the sand particles away. And you literally have a continuous mosaic, a pavement of rocks that are hard as a rock. In other words, you can hit them with it and it just bounces off. And it has a veneer on it. That veneer is called desert varnish. Desert varnish is, alternatively, some say it's a biological element. Some say it's typically chemicals. But it's an iron manganese accretion that grows on the rocks and turns them light brown, dark brown, black, blue. And black is the ace of spades. And so if we want to create a geoglyph, very simply, we remove certain rocks and you show the underlying lighter basement rock or really the sand is what it is. And so you can create a picture from that kind of activity. And that's what a geoglyph is. Some of those are enormous, like in Nazca on the Pampas in the Chilean area where it almost never rains. I just talked with someone who does research out there. And he said there was upwards of 5,000 different geoglyphs on the desert pavement on the Nazca Plain. Now, in California, there's hundreds of them on both sides of the Colorado. And these often are figurative images that have been done by what's called the Mojave Indians, M-O-H-A-V-E, they're human, Y-U-M-A-N, speakers. And these were agriculturalists. And they wrote their religion, their cosmology on the land so that these were beings and these were stories that tell the mythological oral traditions, the creation stories about the universe and about the world written on the landscape. So that's a geoglyph. Wow.
Now, what's an intaglio then?
Same thing. There's three different names for the same thing. Geoglyph, intaglios, gravel figurines. All those are just different names for the same phenomenon.
Okay. Okay. Because I've only ever heard intaglios used down in Southern California, like the famous Blythe intaglios is the one that comes to mind.
Yeah. And they use the same term even for the Nazca figures as well.
Okay. Now, would you consider, or where would you place, I should say, if this even really comes under the purview of rock art, to be honest, but like the giant, like mound figurines, like you've got like a serpent shaped mound and stuff like that in the Ohio Valley. Does that fall under rock art?
It does. It's a geoglyph. Yeah. It's a giant ground figure. It's an intaglio, all the above. Yeah.
Yeah.
And on some cases you have this, you know, sort of this rock alignment, but you also have it created as an effigy.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, there's a famous cave, they call it Zoo Cave. Mm-hmm. It's there on the south base of the China Lake Naval Weapons Center. And there's an effigy. What I mean by an effigy is I mean they took a rock and then made it appear as though it was a serpent. And so they have a rock alignment that is a circuitous circuit, and they even put rocks there to show the eyes and the tail, the actually rattlers of the rattlesnake on top of a image that appears like the face and mouth of a snake. So anyways, that's what's going on with these effigies that depict certain cosmological beings. It's very popular to have depictions of snakes, but there is other images that show other beings, other zoomorphic or anthropomorphic figures that are done with rocks in the desert. There's one that's called the running man that shows an individual running. There's a fisherman. There's a fish. Then if you look at the Nazca lines, they've got incredible images of, they got a monkey, a snake, a scorpion, on and on and on. Everything under the sun is depicted out there.
Well, I'll tell you what, depicting snakes near the China Lake Naval Weapons Center is not a surprise to me. I never was terrified by so many snakes in my life as I was at that base. there was just snakes everywhere.
So they were prominent.
Prominent, you could say that. I mean, when the base took over in the 40s, when they took over that land from all the ranchers that were there, I mean, it was already a pretty remote area and there was a lot of places that people just weren't existing in, and now there's no real predators because the biggest predators for the snakes were really humans,
right?
You know, that would shoot them, and now there's no predators. So the snakes, like the Mojave green rattlesnake, it's just everywhere, and it attacks you. Like, it doesn't just run away when you see it. You don't scare it. You scare it for a second, and then it comes towards you.
Really?
So, yeah, they were something. We'd see a dozen in a day sometimes, you know, all over the place. So, I mean, it was pretty prolific out there.
So the question is, and this is a good one, we bring up snakes, right? So someone would say, well, why snakes?
Yeah.
Why do you depict snakes on rock art? Why do you paint them?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you draw them? Why do you depict them in effigies? Why do you worship or embellish a landform that looks like a snake.
Yeah.
What's with snakes, Alan?
Right.
So I never knew until I began to study it very, very deeply.
Mm-hmm.
Snakes, well, certainly rattlesnakes amongst all other snakes, is an apex predator. It can kill you, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. It's viewed with a bit of fear and trepidation, correct?
Right.
So typically, those are the kinds of what they call indexical animals that are part of the cosmology, the religion, the metaphor for native people. Now, why would a snake be considered part of sort of the religious realm of native people? Well, it's an interesting character. One is it kind of rolls on its belly and it kind mm-hmm. of goes along the ground, but it kind of moves in this circuitous way. So what they saw was an alignment or a metaphor or a simile with water. So they saw the mm-hmm. snake moving almost in a way that the water moves.
Right.
Then they saw that the snake sheds its skin. There really wasn't any other animal that they could see that sheds its skin like that. They thought it was mm-hmm. a metaphor for resurrection, for death and new life.
Yeah.
When a body is open, when it's split open, or when you look inside of it, what do you see? You see intestines, you see veins, you see arteries. Mm-hmm. Well, the native people said, those look to me like snakes. So they thought snakes were a enervating or energizing element of life.
Jeez.
The other thing that happens is when it rains, what happens? Well, the rain comes and fills the burrows of the snakes, and the snakes come out of the burrows because they're all rained on and flooded. So mm-hmm. in native minds, the snakes bring the rain. So snakes were rain bringers. And so snakes were associated with water and rain and bringing new life and plants.
Mm-hmm.
And also with this reiteration, this circuitous motion. They're also the animals that are liminal. What do I mean by liminal? They live in two worlds. They live on the surface of the ground, but under the ground.
Mm-hmm.
What's another liminal animal, Alan? Well, the chuckawalla. What's a chuckawalla? What's a big fat animal, lizard, that lives in the rocks in the desert, but wedges itself into the cracks. And so it suns itself on top of the rocks, but gets inside in the cracks. What's another liminal animal? The quail. You can't see it. Quails are always gone, but then you hear them and they scare you to death. They come out of everything and they're running around.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of in the brush, but then they appear and they kind of run along the ground. They don't really fly very much. So they're considered these ground birds. So these are liminal creatures that live in two worlds. The native people were obsessed with connections or relationships between oppositions. And so the surface plus the undersurface was seen as an envelope or a corridor or a connection between the natural and the supernatural, between the terrestrial world and the underworld. So this could be perceived or represented in animal form.
Okay.
Bet you didn't know all that, did you?
I didn't, actually. Yeah. It's interesting the parallels with different civilizations, because a number of civilizations around the planet have had this fascination, for lack of a better word, between light and dark, the underworld and, you know, the living world. And, you know, and really from a, you know, they lived in darkness a lot of times, pre-fire especially, but even with fire, like you go away from the fire pit and you're back in the darkness again. So the darkness is all around them, and understanding these things was probably really tough. So they did the best they could with the, you know, resources they had.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's funny because as we have begun to understand more specifically and in greater depth, native thought, native healing mm-hmm. practices, native religion, we've come mm-hmm. to find that their perceptions are not as fanciful or as impractical as we might have imagined. In other words, a lot of the ways the healing modalities that they had, the ethnobotanicals, and even the medicine doctors that they had, mm-hmm. did things that affected our physiology in ways that our conventional medicine can't do. And it has mm-hmm. been a very effective way of sometimes transforming people's lives from sickness into health.
Okay. Well, that is a positive note to end this segment on. So let's do that. And we will come back on the other side and talk about just a couple more items I have on my list here for different types or techniques of rock art. And we'll do that on the other side. Back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. All right, welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 28, and we're going to continue talking about just a couple things that I've got on my list here that I've written down as we've discussed all these items. And we talked about techniques back in episode 25, and we talked about a couple of different, I guess, not only techniques, but types and styles of rock art. But one thing that was just briefly mentioned, but we didn't really discuss, and that's why I wrote it down, was scratched. What does scratched mean when you hear about that in reference to rock art?
So for the longest time, actually, most rock art scientists, even in the Great Basin, in the Desert West and the Far West, didn't recognize that there was a type of rock art called scratched. For instance, when the Coso rock art mm-hmm. of Eastern California was documented, and they documented tens of thousands of glyphs, they didn't record a single scratched rock art element, not a one. So fast forward, you know, many decades further along and more recently, mm-hmm. and everybody said, what are all these scritches and scratches going all over this rock art? They said, well, maybe somebody tried to, you know, eradicate it, or maybe they were trying to vandalize it. They says, no, there's different symbols in there and there's different styles. And this isn't just, you know, random scratching. They're putting them into different patterns. They're rectangulars and they're nets, and there's different, it almost looks like basketry.
Right.
So what they eventually found out was Native people at various times used a single piece of flaked stone to scratch, typically on some sort of a desert varnished rock face, and it created an image. It's a very light image, and it cannot be seen well unless you're looking at it in sort of glancing light, or whether there's cloud cover, or whether you have precisely the right view of it and it shows up. And unless you're looking for it, you'll miss it because it's very, right. very thin, very ephemeral, and very light. So they found the thing called scratched rock art. So and then people said, well, how much of this is there? Well, it turns out it's all over the entire Great Basin, as an example. And some places have it much more prominently than others. When they recorded the rock art at a place called Little Lake, mm-hmm. which is on the edge of the Western Great Basin, they found about 6,000 individual instances of rock art, and 20% of them, over 1,000 individual instances of scratched rock art. They said, why is there so much scratched rock art, Alan? Well, what some researchers, I'd say many researchers, even most researchers, have come to the conclusion that scratched rock art, for the most part, the lion's share, is a very late prehistoric expression in the Desert West. So the last group of Indians that were there, Great Basin Paiute Shoshones, embellished. At one point, people thought they were trying to obliterate or deface the earlier rock art. They added scratches to older Great Basin carved or abstract or representational rock art. And you see it.
Yeah.
You can see it. Now, when Joanne Van Tilburg did her study at Little Lake, she found 1,200 instances of rock art of this scratched style. And she had a lot to say about it. She said that it was ephemeral, it was mainly done not curvilinear, but rectilinear. Mm-hmm. And it was also in areas that appeared to be associated with water or with areas that would be prominent places to harvest plants. So she argued that this scratched rock art might be the product of women. It might be a gendered or sexual specific kind of rock art that was performed by and for women.
Right. You did mention early on that these were found on top of, you know, presumably older instances of rock art, because you can tell that the scratch is over the top of it, right? It just, you know, it's digging into it. So is it always found that way?
It's not so easy to differentiate the episode of that rock art. Some people say it's impossible. Okay. Other people say it's obvious that it's superimposed on it and more recent. If you look at it closely, you can see that it's much more recent. It's not as varnished as the older rock art. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to look at it microscopically and to study it so you can dismantle it or deconstruct the episode of when it's produced, which is not so easy.
No, I can't imagine.
Yeah. So also what we found, certainly in Little Petroglyph Canyon, this wasn't supposed to be there, but in other places in the California desert, but certainly in the Coso rock art area, this scratched rock art has little tiny figures, like as big as my thumb. They'll have little decorated animal human figures. They'll have other figures. They'll also have baskets that are scratched. They have horses that are scratched. What else do they have? All kinds of different figures that are scratched in the rocks.
So we do find this stuff on its own, not like with other figures from a different style, presumably above or below it?
It is found on its own, but most commonly it's found in association, either embellishing next to or superimposing older rock art.
Right.
So you can't date it very well because it's so thin, you couldn't really use any sort of XRF, sort of a portable XRF way to, you couldn't get the actual measurement on it. But it's found superimposed on recent milling basins. So you'll see it right next to the most recent episode of, sort of the technology of milling. And you can date the millstones because you can date the actual revarnishing of that basin. And it's recent. It's only a few hundred, about 500 years old at most.
Now, you just opened us up to a conversation about dating, and I was going to bring up XRF. Can you tell us, now that stands for X-ray fluorescence, and I know, man, the world kind of changed when they built the portable XRF, a device that they could take out into a battery-powered thing that they could take out pretty much anywhere and, point it at something and get some data off it. But what can we learn? What does XRF do? What is it looking for? What can we use it on? And what can it tell us specifically relating to rock art?
Well, this portable XRF, as well as some of the, independent XRF machines, are machines that are examining the actual chemistry of rocks. So we're trying to get a quantitative measure of the relative percentages, the relative ubiquity, the relative presence of the chemistry of a rock. Mm-hmm. So in other words, iron, manganese, titanium, all the various chemical elements, the minerals and elements of a rock. So when you do that, if you're examining pigment, you can chemically characterize it and find out what its constituents are, and you can match that with the parent rock and find out its geographical source. They do that with obsidian, volcanic glass. They use an XRF machine to figure out the signature of its various basic elements, its relative percentages, and they can match that and they can source the obsidian. They can do it in the field now. They used to have to take it in the laboratory. But when you're looking at rock art per se, this has been going on for quite some time, there may be a way to date rock art using portable XRF. What you do is you try to get a background reading for the unpecked rock. What's the chemistry of it? And then you also examine the pecked out areas to see what the relative frequency of that basic element is. And the element that works best in that sense is manganese, because it's accreting manganese. So the relative percentages is a function of the background rock and the pecked out rock. And if you subtract them, it gives you a number, and you can calibrate that and figure out how old the glyph is. That's, you know, very simple expression, which gets very complicated because you have rocks that tip up and tip down, and you've got to figure out what's going on, and you got to be sure you have a good reading. You get multiple readings and blah, blah, blah. But when it's been used several times in different ways, it eventually has given us fairly reasonable and relatively consistent measures of the antiquity of rock drawings that are done on desert varnished canvases. And desert varnish is this accretion of clay and water and sun and various chemicals that taint the rock, that paint the rock with this varnish, this accretion that's made of iron and manganese and turns it brown and black and what all the other colors, and it gets it darker, darker, darker. So when it's completely revarnished, we're looking at a image that's about 10,000 years old.
Right.
And that's rather amazing.
Well, you got to take other factors into play too when you're thinking about that, because, and this is what makes science so fun, right? So they can say that it's 10,000 years old, but you're looking at it and saying, well, right now, current temperature and weather variations will produce desert varnish at, you know, X rate, right? But the weather and climate, more specifically, the climate has changed pretty drastically over the last 10,000 years. I mean, 10,000 years ago, we were coming out of an ice age.
Exactly.
So, you know, things were different, and we have different climatic events that have happened throughout time, especially when you start going back that far. So varnish, desert varnish and things like that could have
come and gone.
The rate at which it's created, it changes. It fluctuates through time, and you have to bring in other sources. I mean, that's how we do when we look at like obsidian hydration and things like that, when we're trying to measure like the obsidian growth rind around a piece of obsidian. That changes as well, and we use other sources like ice core data, tree ring data, things like that to get a calibrated picture of that history.
Exactly. So what they do for this desert varnish dating is they try to figure out, well, when did the climate change and when did the varnish start?
Right.
So they'll get an event, like let's say the overflow of the water or the flooding that moved the rocks in there to start accreting. And then they get a radiocarbon date on that, and they can say, well, that's when the varnish started. Here's some examples of the rock. Here's what they are. I know how old that is because I know when that started. I can get a measurement on that. That's my calibration.
Yeah, exactly. We only have a few minutes left in the segment. What other like overall types of dating could there be? And I want, you know, when people are thinking about this, is you kind of have to think outside the box sometimes too, right? Because you could sometimes probably start to date rock art based on what the figures are that you're looking at, because
the subject matter,
The subject matter. You've seen rock art with like, you know, cowboys.
Exactly.
People see cowboy hats. You know, that can't be more than a few hundred years old.
Yeah. Men with hats on animals. With equine situations. We know 1850, 1870, those dates to that particular period when the cowboys were there, when they brought the horses in and et cetera, et cetera. And I've seen those pictures, and I'm very confident that those date to those particular time periods. And it's surprising how well preserved they are. Now, again, and you'll see those both in petroglyphs and in pictographs. And as we go back in time, you've got the bow and arrow. If you go back in time further, you've got the otlatl, the actual, you know, the actual implement that was used to throw the dart, a dart thrower, a dart board.
Right.
And then you can also evaluate the character of those pictures. You can look at the style. You can look at the superimposition. You can even seriate. We can look at, when you do seriation, you talk about when something is innovated, it starts slow. It grows in popularity, and then it wanes. And so if you can look at that particular frequency and sort that from across different locations, you can get a flavor for what's going on, and you can use that to cross-correlate and develop pictures of blocks of time.
Yeah, and you're building on subject matter as well. You could look at the types of animals that are depicted. Maybe there's an animal that hasn't been in that area for a long time, or if you go back far enough, is extinct entirely.
Right.
So
we had someone on our show who went out to the Sahara Desert to see this incredible mm-hmm. rock art, and they talked about hippopotamuses and giraffes that were depicted on the rock art. Well, those haven't been there for a while because you're in the desert now. So they could look at the paleo environment and place those particular panels, I would say approximately, if not very specifically, in blocks of time. And then sometimes we're lucky in other parts of the world, they have writing. And the writing tells you exactly what period of time that relates to.
Yeah.
Well, one gentleman that I worked with, we just published an article about it, uses that particular method of looking at the historic glyphs and the desert varnish and pioneering the actual mechanism of dating that, and took that to the Kosos and then used it again. So we're making some strides, or at least beginning to get a handle on how to go about some of these means of using the interface between science and asking the rocks to speak. And they're starting to answer some preliminary questions. How's that?
You know, hey, here, just in the last minute, I want to explain something too. People, when you talked about, you know, historical dating methods and things like that, a lot of times people have heard of carbon dating and they say, well, why can't you carbon date rock art? Not really thinking about what the word carbon date means, right?
Right.
You can't carbon date rock art because there's no carbon in it, right? Carbon. And even if there was carbon in it, it's not that type of carbon.
Exactly.
You know, carbon is. It's measured. Carbon dating is measuring the quantity of C14 within your body, the carbon 14. And that is, you know, that's provided to you through your environment, right? And it's living organisms that have this, and the decay rate of that is what we're trying to measure. So my question for you is pigments in paintings are made from living organisms in a lot of cases, right? Can you carbon date pigment? Is there enough of it there, or is there enough of it left?
I have radiocarbon dated, using, you know, mass spectroscopy pigment on a painting in the South Fork of the Curd.
Nice.
And we looked at the red, we looked at the white, and we looked at the black. And I think it was the red that they decided was most amenable. And we had some of these, you know, flakes and also blocks of pigment that were coming off of these panels. And I sent it to them, and they said that the white and the black, they could not do, but they did do the red, and there was enough carbon there to produce a date. It was 1,000 years old.
Wow. Nice. And now, so we're literally out of time, but I like to talk about real quick, you can use that date and then help solidify, because you've got 1,000 years with error bars, right? There's going to be plus or minus X number of years, and you can help start to dial that in by subject matter and other things based on the board. So it's not just like looking for the copyright date for the rock art, right? There's never one thing. It's always a suite of materials and a suite of sciences and tools that we have in order to really figure out how old these things are. And then when we figure out how old they are,
we want to cross correlate use as many, many methods as we can to try to, as you say, dial in and get really a block of time. We're not looking for precise date in most cases, because we can't really get that. But sometimes, and we can talk about this on the next episode, sometimes the artisans, you know, lend us a hand. And one of the things that the Coso artisans do, and even other ones in Texas and even in Mexico, is they depict chronologically diagnostic, temporally sensitive projectile point forms in their rock art.
Wow. There you go. That's really cool. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Alan. And
thank you a lot, Chris.
We'll be back again.
God bless you.
Yeah.
And Feliz Navidad. Merry Christmas.
That's right. Oh, yeah. This episode's coming out on, I believe, New Year's Day. So
perfect.
It's 2021. There you go.
Prosperi año felicidad.
That's right. So thanks, Alan. Thanks, everybody. And we will see you guys next week and next year. All right.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. You can find this podcast on the educational podcast app Lyceum, LYCEUM, and wherever you find podcasts. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.